Good afternoon. My name is Trudy Peterson, and this session is Vital Records, the Importance of National Archives and Records Administration in Governance and Civil Society. What we're here today to talk about is the issue of how records and archives foster anti-corruption initiatives, transparency movements, good governance, and democracy. And our three speakers are going to cover three different regions of the globe: Africa, Asia Pacific, and the Caribbean. We're going to start with Mike Hoyle. Mike is an Australian, born in New Zealand, now living in Seattle. That alone equips him, I think, to talk about the Pacific. But Mike has been extremely involved in initiatives established in the Pacific area to try to strengthen archives and records in various countries around the Pacific. He also has worked both in the archives of New Zealand and the archives of Australia. He has had various positions with the governing branch of both the Pacific Area branch of the International Council on Archives and in Australian Society of Archivists. He's also been involved in a number of projects sponsored by his current employer, the International Records Management Trust, including seminars in Johannesburg, South Africa, and recently he has been a consultant in both Sierra Leone and Bangladesh. Mike Hoyle.
Thank you very much, Trudy. I am going to talk about the Pacific, but I just thought, just to let you know, before I came here, I flew from Lesotho, which is a small little country in southern Africa, where there was heavy frost on the ground, there was snow in the mountains, and it was very, very cold. So coming here to DC has been something of a shock to my system, particularly the last few days. I'm going to talk about the Pacific, but we hope to have some good discussion sessions, and I'll probably come in on some of the discussion around Africa as well. I probably won't talk too much about Asia, although, again, I can use some examples, particularly from Bangladesh. In terms of this presentation, some of you would have seen in your program that I was to talk about archives and records management and non-literate governance in Asia Pacific. I must admit, when I looked at the word non-literate, I wondered a little bit exactly what that was going to be and what non-literate governance could possibly mean. Needless to say, when we were putting together this session, both Sarah and I were extremely busy, and we had to really rush things through, and I didn't in fact pick up exactly what was meant by this particular term. But the way that I've interpreted it is to mean oral traditions, oral cultures. And in the Pacific Islands, this is actually a very prominent and important point. When I'm talking about the Pacific Islands, you'll all have to try and get a bit of a map into your minds. We're talking about an area, a huge part of the globe, which stretches from just south of Japan, particularly the Northern Mariana Islands, through to Hawaii, down to Easter Island, down near Chile, across then to New Zealand, Australia, up to Papua New Guinea, and back up to the Mariana, Guam, and the Northern Marianas. So we're talking about that huge body of water there and all the little dots, that little islands that make up that part of the world. Since the word literate has been mentioned, I thought I just would let you know that literate actually means, and looking it up in a dictionary, to be able to read and write. And in the Pacific sense, this is quite interesting. There was no writing before the advent of explorers into the Pacific, into missionaries into the Pacific, and then obviously the colonial input into the Pacific. The one exception was that the Rongorongo script of Easter Island, in fact, has got, we understand, it is a written form, but nobody has in fact been able to ever translate it. So in terms of the Pacific, we really are talking about an area which did not have any form of writing until more recent times. Languages in the Pacific and those Pacific islands are also very, very important. In Papua New Guinea, there are in fact 220 languages. Vanuatu, which is a group of islands near Papua New Guinea, has 113. The Solomon Islands has 62. If we think about the areas of the Pacific, including Micronesia, Polynesia, Melanesia, then there are also multiple languages that go across those those areas as well. Polynesia, for example, has 30 languages. Micronesia has about 15. So in terms of language, it's incredibly important that you be aware that communication and trying to introduce governance is a major issue. Of course, despite the fact that there was no written culture at the beginnings, myth and legend obviously play an extremely important part. And these have been passed down orally, and they can actually encompass everything from the creation, the creation of the earth, the creation of the land, and so on and so forth, through to much more mundane sorts of things, including how to track from island to island, how to navigate from island to island. This was passed down through the generations. As I mentioned, colonialism has had a huge impact. In the Pacific Islands, we have multiple influences, starting with the Spanish, French, British, German, American, Japanese, Australian, and New Zealand. Indeed, one country, Vanuatu, was governed by both Britain and France at the same time. I think it's the only colony, in fact, that had two colonial masters at one given time, which you can imagine from a governance perspective would have led to some quite interesting situations. Obviously, today, English is a predominant language throughout the Pacific Islands. French is also, particularly in French Polynesia and in New Caledonia. But English, particularly in the North Pacific, through the American influences, through Micronesia, Guam, Palau, Northern Marianas, is very big there. And then in the South Pacific, through places like Fiji, Tonga, the Cook Islands, and so on. English tends to dominate. But to some extent, also, that language has also evolved. And you get situations like Papua New Guinea where you get a version of English, often called Pidgin English, which has become the official language. Interestingly, the Solomon Islands also have a Pidgin. Now, that is the dominant language right now there, but there is no accepted written form of Pidgin. It's used throughout the media, it's used in Parliament, it's used interchangeably with English, it's used interchangeably with other island languages. But that language, in fact, is not in a written form, and there's no real agreement on aspects of spelling and so on and so forth for that language. So I guess in terms of non-literate, this is some of the challenges that one might have. But I do want to emphasise that, of course, the Pacific has a very rich culture today of literature, and there is a lot of writing, often in English, but also in French and in some island languages. And that particularly has exploded since the 1960s, where literature has become a major form of self-identity, particularly in places like New Zealand amongst Maori population, where you get Maori literature in both Maori language but also in English. The Cook Islands, Hawaii, of course, and across in up in Guam, the Chamorro have their own quite rich literature as well. So what do we mean by governance? I suppose that's the other thing of the title of my talk here. I'm defining governance as the outcome of the interaction of government, the public service and citizens throughout the political process, policy development, program design, and service delivery. governance can be separated from government, which is an institutional superstructure that society uses to translate politics into policies and legislation. Good governance, and we often hear the words good governance comes through wherever we work, is perceived to provide a framework within which political, social, and economic priorities can be based on a broad consensus in society, and that the voices of the poorest and most vulnerable are heard in the decision-making processes regarding, among others, the allocation of resources or the ways in which citizens are governed. So, in terms of the Pacific Islands, when we talk about governance and government in the Pacific Islands, what do we in fact mean? Most of these societies are extremely small. It's hard to generalise about all of them, but most are very small. Politics is often inextricably entwined with public service functions. It is almost impossible to separate the political environment from your normal public sector or public service sort of environment. Often there are significant challenges within the Pacific Islands. State budgets, they are often highly dependent on donors, on often still in certain situations on colonial masters, if you like. And that leads to quite significant issues in terms of many of the very small Pacific Islands to actually plan properly, to budget, and to resource functions within that they hope to carry out. There are some quite significant challenges, and again, I'm generalising here across the Pacific Islands, and you do need to keep in mind that it varies quite considerably from place to place. If you're looking at a very small country like Tuvalu or Kiribati, you're talking about only a few thousand people, less than 10,000 people. If you're looking at an island called Niue, which has a close association with New Zealand, you're talking at less than 1,500 people. So you're trying to see how would government or governance work in that sort of environment. Needless to say, the Pacific Islands have had difficulties over time. There have been three coups in Fiji Islands. The Solomon Islands are today viewed, certainly up until recently, viewed as a failed state. There was a regional intervention force which was required to rescue that. There are considerable structural and economic problems in Papua New Guinea, Vanuatu and Nauru. There has been instability in the Cook Islands and so on. Palau has had various leaders assassinated in the past. Accumulation of secular and civil society functions in all of these countries has been fairly slow, but it is developing, and I think there are some quite good and strong things which are in fact happening now. So you're all wondering now, where does archives come into all of this? How do we in fact manage the what role does the National Archivist or National Archives play in this governance situation? Well, it's very hard to generalise, I have to say. Some have become quite good. Fiji, for example, has managed to get a quite well-structured National Archives. In fact, it's the Archives and Library of Fiji, and the library, in fact, grew out of the archives, which is a bit of an exception. But in other situations, I have to say that the state of the archives, state of records, is often woeful, often dumped into rooms, poorly lit, poorly controlled, no environmental controls, so on and so forth. So you get almost the full range. In French Polynesia, particularly in French New Caledonia, the facilities, of course, are of exceptionally high standard. Hawaii, of course, being a state of the US, again, has a high standard. But generally speaking, the smaller the place, the more difficult the situation is in terms of the archives. So I would have to say that in the majority of situations, the role of the National Archives is, in fact, in governance issues has, up until fairly recently, been almost minimal. Many of these institutions are, in fact, locked into cultural heritage roles. It's the place you send the old things. They do not necessarily have any mandate whatsoever to get involved in current record keeping, records management. They are often linked in with museums and libraries. And in fact, in a place like Vanuatu, there is one person who is known as the archivist, and he effectively works very closely with the museum and the library as well. Training, capability building, capacity building are enormously challenging for records and the records and archives professions within the Pacific Islands, particularly those smaller islands. But all is not lost. I was, up until I moved to the United States at the beginning of last year, I was the president of the Pacific Regional Branch of the International Council on Archives. So PARBICA is its name. And PARBICA has become increasingly involved in terms of working around record keeping and good governance. PARBICA includes most of the Pacific Islands. It does not include places like Easter Island. But it also does include Australia and New Zealand. And of course, Australia and New Zealand are very, very big players in the Pacific Islands. The emphasis now that PARBICA is putting around good governance, I think, is absolutely essential. PARBICA is looking to develop guidelines and manuals to support improved record keeping in and to support that good governance initiative. At last year's PARBICA meeting, at the 11th General Conference of the branch, PARBICA issued a declaration on record keeping for good governance. And I'll just quickly read these out to you because I think they're very important and it's very much about trying to push a message here. So the first one is recognising the extreme importance of well-managed record keeping systems as a fundamental pillar for good governance. Recalling that the creation and management of records as evidence of decisions and actions is essential to accountability, transparency, and efficiency. Concerned at the condition of the record-keeping systems in some Pacific countries as a result of administrative change, electronic technologies, and cultural factors. Emphasizing the role to be played by national, state, and territory archives and records authorities in leading and supporting the development of effective record-keeping systems across their respective governments. As part of that meeting, I was part of it. I ran a session along with the person I currently work for, Dr. Anne Thurston, there around some of the issues to do with record keeping and good governance. And as part of our panel, we had the National Archivist of Fiji and the Deputy Auditor General of Fiji as well. And we actually ran through some of the questions that we used to evaluate the state of record-keeping systems with the National Archivist in front of the whole PARBICA group and in front of the Deputy Auditor General. And it was a tremendous session to get the archivist, the National Archivist, working very, very closely with the Deputy Auditor General there to actually see what the significant issues are for good record keeping and the sorts of support that is really needed in a place like Fiji to for government and providing that evidence, that transparency and accountability and so on. So to get that to get the National Archivist and the Deputy Auditor General and ourselves working together in front of the full group, I think what we heard afterwards was a real inspiration to many of the Pacific Island archivists. In fact, we were pulled aside by one archivist who said that he had no idea that he could really talk to somebody like an Auditor General to do his particular job. So, in actual fact, there are some really positive things here. I'm just going to wrap up. There's just a couple of things I also need to mention. I mentioned that Australia and New Zealand have played very prominent roles in the Pacific and continue to do so. The National Archives of Australia had present as a staff member attached for 12 months to the Solomon Islands to help the Solomon Islands archives after the collapse, basically, of governments within the Solomon Islands. Some of you would have been at the international roundtable yesterday and would have heard Adrian Cunningham talk about some of this. But in actual fact, that person is faced with an enormous challenges to bring that archives up to any sort of semblance of basic good archival practice and management. In actual fact, the state of the archives in the Solomon Islands was in complete disarray. And it's, to me, really important and very good that the National Archives of Australia has actually made that commitment, and in working along with Pabika to do that. The other place that the archives in New Zealand has also provided tniendous support to Niue. It's a small little island. It was quite devastated by a what's called a cyclone, effectively a hurricane. And in fact, the archives were in fact blown straight out the building and scattered across the island and in fact blown out to sea. And again, it's important that, and it's very good that the archives, National Archives of New Zealand, is providing that support. So on that note, I'd like to thank you.
Our second speaker is Tom Converse, and Tom's career should be an inspiration to anyone who thought that being in a rut was a rut you had to stay in through your entire life, because Tom has changed careers dramatically twice over. He started out, he's a native of Kentucky at the University of Kentucky, got a master's in library science, and went to work for the Kentucky State Archives, and worked there from 1979 to 85, whereupon he said, "I think I'll be a Foreign Service officer." Went into the U.S. Foreign Service and went from essentially Kentucky to Guatemala, where he worked in the counselor section, was posted from Guatemala to Barcelona, Spain, where he worked in the counselor section, went back to Guatemala because he was actually posted to Nicaragua, but he couldn't get in because of political problems, and then eventually got back to Managua, Nicaragua, to reopen the consular section. He points out that he probably processed about 10,000 immigrant visas for the United States during that period, for all of which he had to use the public records of the host country to establish family, lineage, identity. But once in Managua, he said, maybe this isn't right, and he took a job running the library at the U.S. National Archives, which he did for 2 years, and then became, in 1993, the director of the Records Management Program of the Inter-American Development Bank, where he brings his experience from Central America together with his archival experience to run a first-rate records management program for one of the multilateral development banks. Tom is going to talk to us today about both Caribbean and Latin American countries and the records management and archives issues they face.
Well, thank you, Trudy, for a stimulating introduction. I've been a busy boy, but that's okay. It's been fun. And throughout that entire now 27-year career, I have worked with and enjoyed working with both the records created by people and people who use those records and who create them. It's always a challenge and a thrill to see what's created, why it's created, how it's used, how it's abused, why it's abused, why it's used. And as a kind of lead into that, I struggled with the title of this session, Vital Records, The Importance of National Archives and Records Administrators in Governance and Civil Society. Too often it seems to me that it's not really National Archives and Records Administrations in governments and civil society, it's National Archives or Records Administrations. I have seen throughout my career, both in Kentucky and overseas, and back here in my current position, a kind of Jekyll and Hyde or bipolar or schizophrenic relationship between the institutions that create records and the institutions that are supposed to maintain records. And this is across the board, and I don't think that I have any stones to throw about how it's done in Latin America or how it's done in the Caribbean when I can see similar things to a greater or lesser degree in my home state and in my nation here. But having said that, I think that there are ways that you can kind of look to these things, analyze the problems, and one hopes eventually come to a conclusion. I don't know what that conclusion is, but somebody someday will find it. But one of the basic issues to me seems that records administration is an urgent issue, and archives are an important issue. And it's not always easy to make those things collaborate and work well together. I have here, just in the last week, I've been collecting things that have come across my desk at the bank, the Inter-American Development Bank, on the importance of registration, which is part of records administration. If you don't have a cedula, if you don't have a document of identity in most Latin American and Caribbean countries, you don't exist. You can't go to school. You can't join the army. You can't open a business. You can't pay your taxes. You can't get a refund for your taxes. You can't travel. You can't get a passport. So the IDB has recently commissioned a 200-page study here in what's in a name, the importance of identity and registration in Latin America. In particular, this particular thing dealt with a program in Mexico on registration of individuals, in Colombia on family social welfare registration, Peru land titling, Bolivia civil registration and civil society strengthening, whatever that is, and in Haiti voter registration. And this is now becoming a real buzzword in the development community. Just yesterday, there was an announcement that the IDB, the OAS, and UNICEF are combining forces to develop a program for citizen registration across Latin America. Big bucks, probably hundreds of millions of dollars will be spent over the next few years by these institutions registering people. Very urgent. But once they're registered, what do you get? How are you registering them? They're sending people up rivers in dugout canoes with laptops to register newborn babies who would have otherwise no opportunity to get to the capital cities or the municipal areas to be registered. That's wonderful. But what do you do with a laptop with proprietary software on it that has registered an individual 5 years later when that individual who's now got his birth certificate wants to go to school and the birth certificate maybe hasn't been created in a consistent format that's going to be protected over time? I foresee challenges, shall we say, in moving the urgent record creation, which these projects are going full steam ahead for, and transferring those registrations into the important long-term preservation and access areas. And this, I think, is not going to go away. There are all sorts of things. Land registration is another big example where cadastres, which are land use and land ownership maps, are being created electronically with all sorts of wonderful GIS stuff and color coding, and this belongs to the government and the church and individuals. But what are you going to do with that stuff when it comes time to transfer it to an archives that perhaps has had no accession since the 1930s, and then it was colonial records? They're not going to be very well prepared for this unless thought is given at the moment of creation of these records for the acceptance of them down the road. So the issues that I have been lucky enough to see as I've traveled around Latin America and lived in Latin America and the Caribbean and Europe, I might add, as well as the United States, are that the archives, as was mentioned by Michael, often tend to be seen as cultural institutions rather than as integrally related with the governance of the nation. So they become repositories of curiosities or of things that are very important but aren't urgent at all. And in limited budgets, it tends to be the urgent that gets addressed and not necessarily the important. These archives are going to have to face the issues of technological obsolescence. They also have the burden of history in a lot of cases, where in the Latin American Napoleonic Code method of creating and maintaining records, you have, instead of a case file approach like we often see in the United States, where you have a body of records that is built around an action or an individual or an event or a project with different disposal periods for different parts. Maybe the personnel records are going to be a certain thing to keep for so many years, and the environmental impact things more or less. There, everything is tied together with red tape, physically tied together, everything that relates to a given activity that might last for years or might last for weeks in an expediente, as they call it. And so this thing is just unbreakable. There's really no way to manage it. So you will have an expediente or a case that relates to permission given to attend a conference that will be next to, in the numerical sequence, something that relates to the creation of the Panama Canal, maybe. And there's no real easy way to manage those, either in a physical way or in an electronic way. This is a huge challenge to manage, because what happens is records accumulate, and there's really no way to flush them out. So what happens is often they run out of space, and there will be a fire or just a legal piece of paper saying that due to lack of space, everything before 1970 will be destroyed without regard to what that is. It's done by date only. And there was an occasion of that in an Andean country fairly recently where the court system ran out of space, so they destroyed all of their records before 1970, including back to the Spanish colonial period. Boom, gone in one particular district. So these sorts of things are challenges to archivists, to records managers, to historians, to people who like records and people who like people, because how do you get all of these things to play nicely together? There's also another issue that I think is quite interesting in trying to come to grips with this, and that is the issues that constrain the management of archives. And some of these things we don't really think about. You can say there's managerial timidity in certain areas, and that's true. But why is that? An archivist might be offered a collection that is going to be an extremely hot potato. There may be records that involve things that happened in a dictatorship in the 1970s or earlier, or things that might be happening now with involvement in corruption in the government. And if those records are accepted into the archives, and it is then decided by certain people that those records shouldn't exist and say there's another fire, then you lose your entire patrimony, not just those records. So there is what seems like timidity is sometimes a very wise decision made to hold off on the accession of things that might wind up having you burned to the ground or shot. We don't often have to deal with that in our cozy little niches here in the States and Europe. But that's a fact of life for certain people, and it's very hard to judge them on that, judge them negatively, because that's a real issue. Besides the usual issues of budget constraints and organizational placement, Michael mentioned that they're often with the archives are often with the cultural thing. Sometimes it's culture and sports, and if it's culture and sports, sports is always going to win in the budget battle, and then within the cultural battle, they're going to be fighting for funds with the National Symphony and various other things. So it's a huge issue on that. But it's something we have to, as a profession, I think, address and deal with, because not only is the present suffering in terms of a diminution in the quality of the government and governance and civil society, but the future is also going to be suffering as these elements are not brought into the national memory and protected the way that they should be. And I'm somewhat more pessimistic, I guess, perhaps, than my colleagues are, or maybe they just didn't get a chance to go there. I see these things getting worse and not better in the sense that the technology that's driving the urgency of the records creation, the modern records creation, is overwhelming the ability of already modest abilities to accept and manage modern records in an international environment, at least in the area of the world that I am familiar with. It's very difficult to generalize, and I want to certainly not leave the impression that all is dark and gloom. There are national archives in Latin America that are ahead of our archives in terms of their collection of modern records and how they deal with them. It's amazing how the technology is developing in certain countries in Latin America and the Caribbean, and not so much in others. So it's very difficult to generalize, but I'll do it anyway. In general, I really stand by my statement that this is an issue that is going to get worse before it gets better, and it's something that is going to, I think, have to be solved worldwide. We are facing a tsunami of electronic information. Not all of it is created equal. Not all of it is worth keeping. And the decisions that are made in how we choose to keep what we keep and how we manage what we have decided to keep are, I hope, going to be generally applicable. But it's a huge, huge challenge for us. So that said, I will end that cherry part of it and hand it back to Trudy. Thank you.
Our third speaker, Sarah Dem, is another one of these rather complicated personal histories. She holds both Canadian and U.S. citizenship. She lives in London and she works in Africa. All right, this is a very normal sort of thing as we find in the international world. Her master's degree came from the University of Texas. She began working in archives in Harry Ransom Center, I think, in Texas, has worked at places like the Peabody at Harvard. She then worked here in Washington for a couple of years at the new National Museum of the American Indian, and since March of 2003, she's been working for the International Records Management Trust, and she's done projects for the trust in Botswana, Malaysia, Kenya, and Sierra Leone. So we're going to go to another continent with Sarah.
Thank you, Trudy. I'm going to start with a slightly different definition of good governance than Michael's, although I think it's complementary. And I owe mine to our Ghanaian colleague, Mr. Cletus Azengweo. Good governance involves introducing changes in public administration to ensure accountability, transparency, efficiency, and effectiveness in delivery of public services and the protection of citizens' rights. These changes should enhance the relationship between government agencies and civil society groups. The link between records management and governance may be obvious to those of us in the profession, and especially to those who may work in government, but it's not always so to those outside the field, even if they work in government, in the donor community, or as development consultants. Furthermore, this link is not always readily recognizable as a key issue by people who are working in impoverished circumstances where daily subsistence is often under threat. Civil society organizations can provide non-commercial alternatives or complementary provisions to government services. These activities are often in partnership with government and play an important role in the provision of education, health care, emergency relief, and other essential services. This paper will focus on the symbiotic relationship between governance and civil society within the context of international development, using recent government reform and records management programs in Sierra Leone as an example. I had the good fortune to travel to Freetown last year to work on a project that demonstrates how good practices in and awareness of the importance of record keeping can have a positive impact on government reform and civil society. Sierra Leone suffered a 10-year civil war for most of the 1990s, and UN peacekeeping troops entered the country in 1999. Luckily, its archives are stored outside Freetown, and those collections went unmolested during the conflict. However, many government records were destroyed, along with buildings, damaged or left in great disarray. The government ministries, departments, and agencies, or as we like to say, MDAs, of Sierra Leone are making heroic efforts to regain control over their functions and deliver services to citizens. Currently, Sierra Leone is largely dependent on international aid for its economic survival and is under intense political pressure, both internal and external, to resume normal activity, raise employment levels, and increase its strength in the global economy. Civil society groups such as religious organizations, medical charities, and unions are working alongside international donors such as the IMF, the World Bank, the UK Department for International Development, and others to achieve those goals. Due to diminished capacity resulting from the conflict, it's a challenge for government records and information services to adequately assist government agencies and civil society groups in their efforts to support the services, rights, and privileges of citizens. Record-keeping in Sierra Leone was a recurrent theme identified in functional reviews that have been carried out since the 1990s. As early as 1994, the UK Department for International Development, or DFID, then the Overseas Development Agency, supported a consultancy visit to evaluate the requirements for strengthening records management. President Kaba noted in an August 2003 speech, The poor storage and retrieval of information slows down work of the public service and impacts negatively on policy formulation, planning, and financial control. The improvement of record keeping is absolutely essential for moving the reform process forward. In the past, there was a good standard of records management, and government officials readily recognized the consequences of the loss of control of documentary evidence. There's substantial support for a program to tackle records management issues. The government wants an integrated strategy linked to a sound legal and organizational structure and a capacity-building program. Records management improvements have been targeted to underpin the objectives of the National Recovery Program and the Poverty Reduction Strategy. They support efforts to reduce the size of the civil service, strengthen pay and personnel controls, improve services to citizens, assist monitoring, and facilitate the move towards decentralization. Civil society groups can be an effective partner in development and are often not only an alternative voice of public concern, but an indicator of the degree to which the government is successfully delivering services and information, an issue raised in the interviews that are part of the management and functional review process in which civil society groups take part. In 2005, as part of the governance reform program, DFID appointed a consortium led by Public Administration International to develop a human resources management office and implement a records management improvement program. The International Records Management Trust delivered phase one of the records management improvement component of the project during 2005 and 2006. In addition, the Trust contributed records management expertise to the design of the management and functional review program that PAI was also contracted to provide. The management and functional reviews are linked to the government of Sierra Leone's program to promote good governance in the public service in order to restore efficiency and increase the capacity of services to its citizens. The reviews are designed to address issues relating to the need to update legal mandates, appropriate functions and structures, rationalizing staff and working practices, capacity building and MDAs, and effective use of resources. The issue of records management is of great concern to many government officers, and addressing this issue requires a strategic approach. Identifying records management indicators as part of the management and functional review process was acknowledged from the outset of the project as a key area to be covered. The information contained in the MFR report is submitted to Cabinet and must be accurate and consistent. While earlier data collected in the MDAs was accurate, it has not always been consistent, and there was a need for a standardized assessment methodology. This opportunity contributes not only to consistent information and data collection on government practices, but also allows the public archives to raise its profile as a resource for both government and civil society groups. The Sierra Leone Public Archives was formally established in 1965. The law, based on primarily on the UK's Public Records Act of 1958, mandated the public archives to prohibit destruction of records without prior approval, establish an archival authority to give or deny such approval, empower that authority to receive records not authorized for destruction, mandate transfer of records, and confer right of public access to records. It did not empower the archives to regulate records management in government ministries, departments, and agencies. The public archives comes under the Ministry of Education and is managed by an archives steering committee. Based at Fora Bay College outside Freetown, it provides research services to users from the university and the general public. It holds many early colonial records, including the 1788 treaty between Great Britain and Sierra Leone chiefs, the journals of late 16th century governor, General John Clarkson, and photographs from the early 20th century, to name some of its collections. However, it has not provided current government information to citizens on a regular basis. A records management improvement team was set up by the project, comprising the senior government archivist, the public archives staff, new hires and seconded government records personnel, and recent graduates of the Institute of Library and Information Studies at Fora Bay College. The team's goal is to effect the transition of the public archives from a marginal and under-resourced role to a key player in governance reform in Sierra Leone. The project is based on the assumption that good records keeping systems decrease opportunities for fraud and encourage good practice in governance. The project has worked with the team to develop the essential framework to establish a sustainable national records and archives service that will be able to operate with authority in its dealings with other agencies of the state. Prior to the Records Management Improvement Project, the archives comprised five staff, two of whom were graduates. In order to deliver the project, 11 local individuals with the appropriate skills and experience were identified. They all had previous experience on local records management projects funded by such agencies as the World Bank and the British Council, and had skills in restoring order to collapsed record systems. The project was able to bring these professionals together as a strong records management team to introduce reforms during the life of the project and to provide a professional base for sustainable records management operations in the future. The team receives ongoing training in a variety of skills. And as noted earlier, a draft organizational framework for a National Records and Archives Department has also been developed, that includes an organizational chart and a list of positions required over the next 3 years as departmental responsibilities and tasks gradually increase. In addition, in consultation with the Records Management Improvement Team, the project has drafted a new scheme of service for government records staff to attract people with appropriate ability, ambition, and integrity by offering a well-defined career structure in the records class of personnel. The increased capacity of the team, which is effectively the nascent National Archives and Records Service, allows their expertise to be drawn upon for other governance reform projects. In order to support the ongoing participation of the team in management and functional reviews, the Trust provided assistance with developing a standardized assessment methodology. The reviews are essentially a series of interviews and documentation audits carried out by local and international consultants across government and with civil society groups to inform the process. The local management and functional review team is now supplemented by the Records Management Improvement Team, who assess records and information management capacity for the reviews. I traveled to Freetown last year to help design and agree a standard set of assessment questions as a component of those MFR review templates. General questions were developed to enable the MFR teams to obtain an overview of significant issues affecting records management in the MDAs. Detailed records management questions were then developed to enable the RMI team to make consistent contributions to the work of the other team, the MFR team. Questions on records and information management in relation to IT systems were also developed to address the growing number of these systems that are being introduced across government. The questions in each of the three templates were also designed with reference to the records management issues identified earlier in benchmarking reports that I prepared with the Trust in April and July of 2005, and with reference to the International Records Management Standard. These questions cover responsibility for records and information management, records and information management policies and standards, access and tracking, it's a variety of procedures that include access and tracking, capture and registration, disposition in no particular order, and training and competencies. Questions this specific are not usually a part of the management and functional review process, nor are records managers and archivists often given the opportunity to be involved in supporting these reviews. The questions were agreed with both the MFR and the RMI teams and are now part of the standard MFR process. The MFR team regularly calls on the RMI team to supplement the interviews by collecting the more detailed information using the records and information management question templates. The records management questions are not asked of the civil society groups that are interviewed, but they are taken into account when assessing the interview data that's collected. In order to understand the MFR approach and to design appropriate questions, I was privileged to sit in on some of the MFR interviews with government employees and civil society groups. One of the civil society groups interviewed was a fishers union. There are two fishers unions in Sierra Leone that are concerned with such issues as illegal offshore fishing by international commercial operations, and also with identifying and enforcing sustainable methods of local subsistence and commercial fishing operations. It was clear from the interviews that were conducted both in English and in Creole, the local lingua franca, that the fishers found related government controls wanting, and they were also unclear as to which government entities were responsible for addressing those issues, as well as what routes they should take to communicate effectively to the government agencies. Not only did the MFR interviews give the civil society groups a voice often stifled, it successfully identified problem areas in government agencies and ministries. The Public Archives is uniquely positioned to contribute better to this government information to government information services and citizen communication. And it was exciting to see that both government and civil society groups learn more about its role and the expertise there and demand more of records and information management. As a result of the RMI and the MFR projects, the profile of the public archives has been raised at the highest level of government, and enthusiastic support has been shown to extend the project across ministries, departments, and agencies. We're hopeful that the draft legislation will be passed to strengthen the authority of the department and eventually make it a national archives with an increased permanent staff and budget, realistic budget. The project has shown rapid successes that have achieved demonstrable practical improvements in the immediate working environment and functions of key stakeholders in the government of Sierra Leone and in its relations with citizens. These improvements have been carried out by a local team who have rolled out training to empower record staff in the MDA so that skills have been transferred to where they are most needed. The functional areas targeted by the project team are those of the highest priority to government and donors, providing the public archives with a unique opportunity to play a strategic role in governance and governance reform at a critical time in Sierra Leone's economic and social development. Provided that there's ongoing support for the vital function of records management, there's every reason to believe that Sierra Leone can move forward successfully to a position where reliable, authentic records are available to provide authoritative evidence of policies, actions, transactions, and entitlements in support of accountable and transparent democracy. So I'm just going to quickly go through these slides because I've been a bit slow. This is to show you some of Sierra Leone, really. And then, and I just want to say this paper would not be possible without the meticulous and dedicated work of the many trust staff and consultants on the project. And it was an honor to work with the records team in Sierra Leone under the outstanding leadership of senior government archivist Mr. Albert Moore. Thank you.
All right, that's a very quick tour around the world. As we open this discussion, I want to ask the audience a question. I'd like hands raised if you have been in a national archives in a country other than your own. Okay. Now let's try, have you been in a national archives in Europe? Okay. Africa. Latin America, Caribbean. Asia. Pacific Islands. Okay, I think we're seeing that the audience has some experience, but like most of us, we've been across the closest border. We've been to Canada, or we've been in Europe. And what you're hearing here today is the rest of that world of archives that is developing in a very different way and very different sense. The floor is open for questions, comments. Wait a minute, let me do it for the record. The question is, in societies that depend heavily on oral tradition, what are the options for capturing that knowledge and integrating the written and the oral systems? I think that's roughly right.
There is, in fact, I might actually ask Adria to help me out on some of this. There have been projects in the past to capture oral...
For the record, that was Adrian Cunningham from the National Archives of Australia. Okay, you had a question. Let me change the discussion just... Oh, please, go ahead. Okay, for the record, we have two different questions on the floor. One is the relationship of record keeping in international or multinational organizations vis-a-vis record keeping in the country about which the records are being created by that multinational or international. And the second one is the relationship and the two-way relationship between people like consultants going into a country and trying to encourage record-keeping practices and then the effect of the local record-keeping practices back on what the consultant brings, I think. Okay, Tom, why don't we just run right down the panel?
Well, first and foremost,
Well, I'll just add to that by saying that we really work closely with the National Archives and the other senior stakeholders in government, and it's not just coming in and saying here's the system, and good luck. We really try very hard to make things sustainable, and there's a lot of training involved, and there's a lot of listening, and there's a lot of designing things together. So yes, we definitely bring templates in, but we try to design them so that they'll be most effective. You know, with the input from the people who are really going to use the systems. Mm-hmm. I was just thinking about the session earlier this week, one of the first sessions on records keeping as a force of good, in which it was mentioned how important individuals are, and it often does come down to individual integrity and goodwill. And I personally have been lucky enough to encounter a lot of that in the work that I've done with the trust, and it's very rewarding, but that's a big part of it, and it takes a lot of strength in a lot of the countries that we work in for those individuals there to maintain that.
Let me ask the three of you. Certainly dictatorships often have very good record-keeping systems. Are there countries that, if asked, you would not work in because you realize that by strengthening the record-keeping system, you would strengthen a government that you do not approve of? I'm not asking for names of countries, but is this a decision you make, or is the decision that strengthening record-keeping is such a good that you would ignore the type of government you're working with?
I'm not sure I can add much to what my colleagues have said, except that personally I've been lucky not to have to make that hard decision in my work, mm-hmm. Although it's obviously something that you have to think about.
So then, panelists, what is the link between good record keeping and democracy? Where does the hinge come? Sarah, you want to take that one so you don't have to follow these fellows?
Well, I think transparency. That hopefully, ideally, if good governance involves transparency, that is the link to democracy. I don't think anyone pretends that we've achieved ideal democracy anywhere. It's a goal, and it's a goal that the work that we do it tries to.
Let me repeat this to make sure everybody hears. The question is, what about access to the records by the people who are participating or on whom the records are created?
I think it's extremely important.
That is why a lot of the work that we do involves drafting legislation that takes that into account, and that's often a part of the program. If we come in to work on a large records management improvement program, we're looking at that whole framework. And not just, you know, one single area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, I agree entirely. Access is absolutely fundamental.
I'm hoping that for the record I can say simply the statement is that the electronic record's inevitable deterioration in a country with limited financial resources puts at risk the record history of the country. And then he points out that there is an additional culture of dependency that comes when a large-scale project is done and the electronic record then is maintained outside the country.
I mean, you're absolutely right. I think electronic environment, perhaps Sarah.
Well, I'll just say on an optimistic note that the good thing is that there is an increased interest in records management requirements for these systems. That's you know, what we're focusing on in an attempt to at least raise these questions at the beginning of implementation or design of the system instead of waiting until after the fact, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask then a final question. When you're looking at a country that has gone through a dramatic change of government, do you see the opposite tendency in access policy? That is, let's throw open all the records of the past government without thinking through the questions of privacy and other issues that you see in the records, irrespective of the form of government. No?
No, I haven't either, but I can imagine that situation, but I haven't actually come across that. Often there's a way of exposing the predecessor government to whatever ills. Mm-hmm. But I don't think any of the work that I've done, I've ever actually seen that anywhere in the actual fact occur.
That's interesting. Final questions from anyone? If not, thank you very much.